Good morning. This meeting of House Education will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd, and the time is 8:04 a.m. Members of House Education present are Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Zach Fansler, Representative Jennifer Johnson, Representative Chuck Kopp, Representative Dave Tallarico, and myself, Representative Harriet Drummond. We have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones. Today, our recording secretary, as usual, is Kelly Burnett and Alex Beebe Guidice, our LIO moderator, assisting with recording and teleconference support. Thank you both. Today, we are hearing House Bill 146, School Tax, PFD Payment for School Tax. This is a substantial bill, and I'm sure there'll be questions for the bill sponsor. So my intent today is to hear this bill and hold it before we have public testimony at a later date. So if the bill sponsor would like to come forward and proceed with your presentation. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Klayman, and I am the state representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. I want to thank you all for hearing House Bill 146. Alaska faces major financial challenges. Our goal in proposing House Bill 146, a school tax, is a responsible action plan to meet those challenges. The Alaska Constitution, Article 7, Section 1, requires the legislature to establish and maintain a system of public schools. The public supports a strong public school system, and our investment in students is our best investment in the future. When asked about the possibility of a broad-based tax that would be a school tax, many people wanted to know what would such a tax look like. The school tax in House Bill 146 sets a tax based on adjusted gross income on federal tax returns for every person who earns income in Alaska. All Alaskans and out-of-state residents who work in Alaska will help solve our financial challenges. The minimum tax would be $100 a year for those who make $20,000 or less. In this way, the school tax is similar to the school head tax. Everyone contributes. The tax then increases on a graduated scale based on income. Those making between $50,000 and $75,000 a year would pay a school tax of $750. The revenue collected from the school tax would be designated to support public education in Alaska. It is not a dedicated tax fund, which would violate our Constitution. The values of the tax range from 1% in the lowest bracket to 3.4% at the uppermost bracket. There is also a cap on the uppermost level, allowing the highest earners to reinvest in the economy and support a positive investment climate. We based our values off a $1,000 permanent fund dividend. Everyone is able to contribute, while individuals who depend on the permanent fund dividend still receive a reasonable portion. To make payment of the tax simple, the bill includes a provision allowing use of future permanent fund dividends to pay the tax. I would like to close by saying that this school tax bill responds to public concern about the funding of education in challenging times. It is a transparent way to produce new revenue and create a responsible action plan for Alaska. At full implementation, the school tax bill is projected to raise $540 million, approximately one-third of the state funding for education. We believe that if the public has a more direct investment in funding education, they will become more involved in the education that we deliver. The school tax is not a proposal to increase education funding. The intent is to raise revenue to help close the budget deficit, designate those funds to support education, and reduce the undesignated general fund appropriation for education on a dollar-for-dollar basis. And with that, I will now turn it over to my staff member, Owen Phillips, to tell you a little bit more about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. For the record, my name is Owen Phillips, and I'm staff for Representative Klayman. First, I would like to provide a brief sectional analysis of the bill. Please note, while this is a sponsor substitute, the only change from the original bill is the title. The old title did not include out-of-state residents or specify income. Let's begin with Section 1. Section 1 concerns the use of permanent fund dividend as payment for the tax. This section directs the Department of Revenue to prepare the permanent fund application to allow an applicant to hold their permanent fund dividend to pay the tax. Section 2 is the meat of the bill. Its features include requiring residents and non-residents with income from a source in-state to pay the school tax, a school tax based on adjusted gross income broken into progressive levels. The lowest, less than $20,000, are required to pay $100. This will include those individuals who only collect a permanent fund dividend. At the top of the scale, there is a cap for taxpayers whose adjusted gross income is greater than $250,000. This cap will allow individuals to reinvest in the economy, making a positive investment climate. For the purposes of this bill, adjusted gross income for a resident is their total adjusted gross income, whereas non-residents or part-time residents' adjusted gross income is calculated from that earned in state. The tax is assessed per tax return. The tax is assessed per tax return, meaning that joint filers will pay based on total adjusted gross income. The bill allows the Department of Revenue to establish procedures for collection of the tax, including regulations for use of the permanent fund dividend. There are also lines that explain the repercussions for failure to pay on time and procedure for requesting extensions. Regulations include an annual interest rate of 18% on delinquent taxes, assessment of fees up to $2,500 for the collection of delinquent taxes, a 90-day extension with departmental discretion, and determination of adjusted gross income for joint filers who are not both state residents. Section 3 allows the Department of Revenue to adopt regulations to implement this act. Section 4 sets an immediate effective date for Section 3. And Section 5 sets an effective date of January 1st, 2018 for the rest of the Act, which includes the tax component of the bill. I will note that this effective date accounts for the lower revenue calculation of the first year of implementation on the fiscal note of the Department of Revenue, OMB 2476. Before I conclude, I'll mention for the record that Emily Nauman, the bill drafter from Ledge Legal, should be online, and Ken Alper, the drafter of the fiscal note and director of the tax division of the Department of Revenue, is in the room. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 146, and with that, Madam Chair, we will be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips, and Representative Klayman. Would you like any of your revenue or Ledge Legal folks to testify to us at this time?
Madam Chair, I think that we'll just have them available for any questions.
Okay. Very good. And Representative Sponholz showed up while I wasn't looking. questions from the committee. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This could either be for the sponsor or the tax department. Lainey Walsh brought up in her last week's column the fishing industry and the issue of the 1099 forms and some of the fish permit holders felt that the state might be making them the tax collectors. How do you approach, or what would be your response to that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I'm sorry. I didn't
put
read Lainey.
Put yourself on the record once again, Representative Matt Klayman.
I didn't read Lainey Welch's editorial, so I can't really comment on what she's saying. I think one of the differences between the income tax proposal that Representative Seaton has introduced, we're not having a payroll tax as part of this bill. This bill is actually a payment that's due at the end of the year. There would be a single payment that would be due, and that would be based on income. And we have collection fees for non-payment of up to $2,500, plus a fairly steep interest rate for non-payment, so that would create incentives. So essentially, we're not asking fishing boat owners to collect the tax. The people that would earn that would get reported to the state, and if they haven't paid, then they would face potential significant interest and a collection fee associated with their non-payment.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
To that point you raised last, this fee of not more than $2,500 for collected delinquent tax and an 18% interest rate on the delinquent taxes, those seem very aggressive to me. What alternatives to having that aggressive system of disincentives do you see as being viable?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, we did not want to have a payroll tax that's collected on a monthly basis by employers through the Department of Revenue. And so when you're looking at, I mean, it's kind of the classic carrot or stick, and payroll tax is probably a somewhat of a more carrot approach. This basically says you need to pay, and if you don't pay, then there's got to be some meaningful consequences for non-payment. Of course, people that may not want to pay might choose not to apply for their permanent fund, but at the lower income levels, you're making a choice between a $1,000 permanent fund, of which $100 would pay the tax, and not collecting a permanent fund at all.
Go ahead. Thank you. So I think it's no secret that all of us would like a robust permanent fund to the degree that it's possible. But because that money is already passing through the hands of the state on its way to the resource owner, wouldn't that provide us with a mechanism of collecting which wouldn't need to have these stiff penalties? You could, I certainly know that most people's investments are not offering them an 18% return, and indeed for most of the saving options available to members of the general public, it's far and away above what they could anticipate. And the fee of $2,500, I appreciate that it's an upper bound, but I would like to see it somehow connected with the outstanding liability. If someone makes less than $20,000 in a year, and the person setting the fee schedule for whatever reason doesn't like them, they could be assessed a $2,500 additional burden. And that's difficult. I'd like to see some limitation to that, or some guidelines to that, where you wouldn't have people with a very small delinquent tax paying an exorbitant fee. I would propose that in the place of these, for people who live here for a while, you could, I hate to say it, but you could garnish their future PFD receipts to cover with a small rate of return, maybe, well, not more than 10%, I would hope, from their previous tax, from their future PFD payment.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, the bill specifically allows payment through the PFD. So if one is collecting a PFD, there would be no reason to incur a penalty, particularly at the lower tax levels, because you would check the box on your permanent fund and say, pay my school tax from my PFD. And so the failure to pay would not be from the inability to pay that from the PFD. It would be simply the fact that they didn't choose what was a very available and manageable way to pay the tax, which would be check a box on their permanent fund application. The deduction would be made from the permanent fund, and there would be no penalty and there would be no interest.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The time value of money is something we've been hearing an awful lot in our resources committee. And I think it's more true for people who are living sort of at the margins than it is for most other people. If I'm anticipating carrying some debt when it comes to PFD season, that money right then could let me pay down my credit card or pay my heating bill or any other number of really urgent causes that I might think, I'll get the money for the taxes. Things will work out. I know I've been promised this other job, but the unexpected happens. And a lot of people who live close to the margins, the unexpected, it seems to happen to a lot. And this, I think there's got to be a mechanism for when families are hit by something unexpected, or when individuals, a source of revenue doesn't come through, and an unexpected debt falls upon them. I think there should be some minimally punishing mechanism for rolling that tax liability onto the next PFD and maybe having it automatically deducted if they didn't pay it otherwise, with some lower interest rate to, well, avoid it being as bad as a credit card, except with a much more aggressive delinquency fee. So I
Representative Parrish?
I'd be interested in working with you on something that would be mutually acceptable and meet with the approval of the committee.
My intent is to hold the bill and take amendments at the next hearing if it gets to that, and that sounds like you have good fodder for potential amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Claiming, did you wish to?
Through the Chair, I didn't hear a question, so I can't. I find his comments interesting, but I didn't hear a question. So.
Right. Any other questions? I see. Representative Kopp, go
sure.
ahead.
So, Representative Killiam, I appreciate that you're trying to figure out how we can fund education. I get that. The way this is structured as an income tax is you know, on its face, that's, you know, it's what it is. And you know, we used to have an education head tax that was I think it might have been a payroll tax, Madam Chair. I'm not sure on that. But my main concern with how this is structured is it is an income tax at a time when Alaska is in a recession, and putting money kind of into the economy is what I think a lot of us are driving at, rather than taking money out of it. We have the highest transportation, highest energy, and highest health care costs in the country right now. And my concern with the way this is rolled out as an income tax and its progressivity is basically a similar concern that I would have with the income tax provision in House Bill 115, although this makes House Bill 115 look pretty good on the fact that it's only House Bill 115, I think it's only 15% of your federal income tax liability. But I just, you know, what is your, my question is how would you see this strengthening our economy overall at this time? And do you see this as a dollar for dollar replacement for GF spend already on education, or is this going to add another $500 million to education? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the Chair, Representative Kopp, first, this is not an income tax, it's a school tax, and there's three areas in which it differs significantly from an income tax. First is there's modeled after the school tax of old, or the school head tax. There's a, everyone contributes similar to the school head tax. I believe the school head tax years ago was something in the $10 range on the first paycheck. I see Representative Johnston nodding, so that her memory is apparently about the same as mine on that. And it starts with a head tax at $100 that everyone would contribute, and then, unlike an income tax, it's capped. And that, so that at the $250,000 income level, the payment is capped, which means that in the investment climate, it means those that would be most able to reinvest in the economy would have their tax, there would be a cap on the tax what would owed, which would increase capital investment, or it would leave capital more available to invest in growing businesses. And the third part about the economy is that I'm hearing again and again from economists that have studied the problem that we have, that we need to have a plan that's going to close the deficit that the state faces, or we run out of savings. and the range that I see projected that we need to contribute in terms of new revenue tends to run in the $550 to $850 million range. This is projected to get $560 million, so it's on the low end of the revenue that would be needed to really keep a well-functioning state government, a lean and no-fat state government, which is consistent with the cuts. But if we're going to have a strong economy going forward, we run the risk, and I mean, you've heard the same presentations. I'm not going to try to be the economic expert. The challenge is that if we don't have new revenue, we may do as much or more damage to the economy going forward than if we ignore the need for new revenue. And I frankly haven't seen any of the different economists that have come and touring the state and coming to the Capitol and talking about it that don't see the need for some new revenue to close that gap.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Kopp.
So this is a permissive, it's to avoid a constitutional dedication. The legislature could take this money and spend it on whatever need was most urgent. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. And actually, the earlier question was, this is not thought of as an increase in education funding. It would be now, if we're our undesignated general fund contribution to education is in the 1.4 to 1.5 billion, this would become a designated general fund, and that would reduce the undesignated allocation by a dollar on a dollar for dollar basis. The goal is for the public to be able to say, I'm paying, this tax is going to support public education. I am confident that when I'm writing the check that the legislature, by designating it, I don't expect it's going to be getting paid on something else that a person in the public may feel like we may be less happy paying that. I mean, I'm under no delusion. There'll be lots of complaints no matter what happens with a proposal like this. But the goal is for the public to be able to say, I know this is going to our schools. And our hope as well is that it will cause an increased engagement by the public in our public education, which I think is a good thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Any questions from other committee members? I have a couple of my own. Do you feel you have sufficiently compared it to the income tax bill, House Bill 115, at this point in the conversation?
Madam Chair, we have certainly compared it. Part of what we wanted to do, it is proposed as an alternative, that it wouldn't be that one supports a school tax and in addition an income tax. The idea would be we have to make choices, and so this is an alternative, and part of it is to create a simple and understandable indication to the public of what they would actually pay, so there's no formulas they have to figure out. You can look and see, here's how much, if this is how much I earn, this is how much I would pay. And we wanted to have a different collection mechanism so that, again, in the world of alternatives, it's a different approach. And so whether we've completely compared the two, that would be really a question for members of the committee and other members of the legislature. But we have certainly looked at the House Bill 115 to make some comparisons and make some distinctions.
I see a furrowed brow.
No, I'm thinking of a question. I'm sorry.
Okay, good. I've observed at the low end, it's definitely a head tax. Will even children who only get a permanent fund dividend as income also be paying that $100? I haven't filled out a tax form with children on it in a while, so I don't recall exactly how we pay taxes for our children with the with their permanent fund dividend being their sole income.
Madam Chair, some of the details I can't answer. I can only answer from, at this level, personal experience. I know in my family we were advised by our accountant when our kids were under 20 or under 18 that they should file separate tax returns in relation to reporting their income from their permanent funder. And so under this bill, I mean, for example, in my family of four, when our kids were under 18, in our family of four under this bill, the kids would each pay $100 head tax because they filed a tax return, and my wife and I, who filed a joint return, would pay a school tax based on our income, our joint income, and so that would mean we would make three tax payments to the state under this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if instead the advice came from our accountants to file our children's income on our income, then we would file a single school tax payment based on the joint tax return.
And in terms of the, I want to call them the hard brackets, where there's a jump from $100,000 in income to $101,000, the income tax or the school tax jumps from $1,000 to $2,500. And the hard jump again at the next level from $150,000 to $151,000, it jumps from $2,500 to $5,000. Is there a reason that was not made more of a smooth curve rather than a hard step, so to speak?
Our goal was a simple structure that was very transparent to the public. One could certainly increase the steps and narrow the ranges and make a smoother curve, but in looking at it, we wanted to try to minimize the number of steps on the curve, and once you start minimizing the steps, it's kind of mathematically impossible to do that without having some significant steps at different levels. It could certainly be done with a lot more steps, but part of the intent in the bill is to actually not have somebody say, what's the percentage and what do I pay, but to actually be able to look at it and say, here's what I'm going to have to pay if I earn this much.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Parrish, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I imagine that for the purposes of this bill, a resident of the state of Alaska, someone who collects a PFD, and I imagine a non-resident is someone who is not a resident of Alaska and does not collect a PFD. What is a part-year resident? How is that defined?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish, that's an area in which we would expect the Department of Revenue to come up with regulations that spell that out. And a perfect example of a part-year resident would be referencing back to Representative Johnston's question about the fishing industry, would be someone who works in the summer in Alaska on a fishing boat or works in the summer in Alaska on a tour operation and earns income for a limited number of months but not year-round. That would be a part-year resident. I would also note that the courts and the Department of Revenue have defined resident for purposes of the permanent fund based on you have to be a year resident to obtain a permanent fund, and I believe for tax purposes I'm not speaking for the department, but I would predict that what qualifies as an Alaska resident for purposes of owing the school tax would be a much shorter period. It would basically be, did you work here and how much money did you earn?
Go ahead, Representative Parrish. Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to try to remember to ask Department of Revenue about the part-year, or about these three categories.
And on that point, we're going to lose Ken Alper at 8:55, so perhaps this would be a good time to break for questions for him.
Sure.
Would that be all right? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. I apologize for putting a timeline on my ability to be here.
Right.
I was in a hearing upstairs on the fifth floor that got recessed till 9 o'clock this morning, so I have to be back for it. Should I answer Representative Parrish's question, or would you like to restate it?
Representative Parrish, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple, with your indulgence.
Yes, go ahead.
How in this bill would you interpret resident, non-resident, or part-year resident? What definitions would you fall upon?
So, through the chair, Representative Parrish, really the most important definition in the bill is income from a source in the state. That's what we would need to pin down. It really doesn't matter whether someone's a resident or a non-resident. We would need some mechanism of parsing out what share of their income was originating in Alaska in some way, and we would only be taxing based on that portion of the income, what bracket the person fell into.
Follow?
Go ahead, Representative Parrish.
It seems like in, I believe it's Section 2, Subsection C, Subsection 1, Subsection A, the adjusted gross income is for a resident is the total adjusted gross income of the resident, and it doesn't in that stipulate that it should be the total gross income earned in state. So if, for instance, an Alaskan lawyer were to leave the state for a week and consult in California or Washington, it would be my reading, and I'm not in the tax division, that would be part of their taxable income for the purposes of this bill. Would you read it differently?
So through the chair, Representative Parrish, and to be clear, the tax division, while we are doing our best with a number of bills like this, there is no specific expertise on personal income taxes and similar taxes. The last such tax was repealed over 35 years ago, and you'll note in the fiscal note some consulting services to make sure we get together a complete implementation plan as we build the software and staff up for this. I will say, generally speaking, when you're for an in-state resident, the way the taxes are structured, the way we're working with the finance co-chair to help get his bill fully functional, the tax in-state would be all of the residents' income would be taxed, and then typically, if that lawyer who also earns money, say in California, is paying a California state income tax, there would be a mechanism for the income tax paid to the non-resident state, California, to be somehow a credit against the Alaska income tax. That's the way these things are typically administered.
Go ahead, Representative Parrish.
That segues nicely to my other question. It's my understanding that at present, a Californian working in both Alaska and California will remit to California a tax based on their total annual income rather than just the portion attributable to their time in California. Is that correct?
So, Representative Parrish, that's a good observation, and that's because Alaska doesn't have a personal income tax or similar. Were a bill like this to pass, that a California resident with income earned in Alaska, say someone who has a fishing business seasonally up here, would then get a credit against their California income tax for their Alaska income tax. Comparably, if you have an Alaskan lawyer who works in Texas or Washington, states that don't have a personal income tax, we would be able to tax all of their income because there would be no local state income tax against which they'd be able to credit it back.
One more follow-up, and then I'll let it go to another.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questioner.
It's my observation, though, that in this bill we wouldn't be collecting any revenue from Washington or California revenues, even though legally we've got a right to, under the established system, in the same way that California is exercising its right to collect income tax on income made in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I think it's actually the opposite. The section you pointed out, C1A, we would tax the resident's income wherever it was located. What may be missing from this bill is the mechanism for the credit for taxes paid to other states.
C1B.
C1B is the non-resident. The non-Alaskan resident, we don't have any ability to tax their out-of-state income, and that's comparably true. An Alaska resident earning income in California can't be taxed by California on their Alaska originating income currently. It doesn't, for the non-resident, we would not have the ability to get their out-of-state income. Whereas for the resident, we would be able to, barring a local tax that would credit against it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ken.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, before the next question, I just want to clarify one thing, because when I met with the sponsor yesterday, I was not immediately aware when I put the fiscal note together that there was no payroll tax, there was no withholding component to this bill. That changes things a little bit. My expectation is the staffing need would be a little bit lower once we work through that, but more immediately important, I would expect to not see any revenue in fiscal year 2018. The first returns wouldn't be due until the end of calendar year 18, which would be in fiscal year 19. So with a full 540 and beyond would hold, but that $270 million in FY18 would fall out of the fiscal note.
Okay. Great. So at some point, I assume there would be a new fiscal note reflecting your understanding.
Yes, ma'am.
Of the mechanism. Okay. Thank you, sir. Representative Johnson.
That leads right into my question as far as modeling and how you modeled the revenues. What labor year of your labor workforce did you use for numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I don't know precisely. I think the last complete data set we have is 2014. Our economic research group has an IRS data set of number of Alaska filers by income level, total income, that sort of thing. There's a little bit of massaging of the data needed to be done for this because you're sort of combining individual and joint filings into a single table, but we came up with a reasonable algorithm for that and came up with the number of households that would be filing at the different levels, came up with the number. And then our convention for these sorts of bills is to not try to inflate the number, so the current year number is the $540 million. Realistically, given inflation or economic growth, population change, that number would change in the out years, but we use the same modeling for all years of the analysis.
And so your workforce is 2014, or your data set is from 2014?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'll have to get back to you with certainty, but I'm fairly sure it's 2014.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson and Mr. Alper. The fiscal note says that the burden for the tax division is pretty significant. And I assume as you work through all of these potential revenue bills, you'll have a better handle on that. Would you say it's a significant burden?
So, Madam Chair, the tax division currently administers about 25 different tax programs right now, half a dozen different fish taxes. We're probably best known for the oil and gas production tax, but Alaska's motor fuel and tobacco and alcohol and cruise ship head tax and all of those type our corporate income tax all flow through the tax division, charitable gaming. Among those, the corporate income tax is our largest universe of taxpayers. We have about 13,000 filers, corporations who file, many of whom are type S corporations that simply file information returns and don't owe taxes. What we're talking about here is 350,000 or 400,000 taxpayers, just a large number of people with whom we're going to have to establish a relationship with. So it's a more robust type of software, and just people, there's inevitably large amounts of inquiries, appeals, an order of magnitude change to the type of business that we currently do.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else you would like to tell us before we let you go?
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. No, I'm happy to take questions for another few minutes, but the bill is pretty straightforward. One observation that I would make is it appears that at about the $250,000 income level, this bill would raise a similar amount of revenue to, say, 115, the income tax bill that's currently upstairs. The difference is, of course, that this bill is sort of a capped tax rate, mm-hmm. whereas if a traditional income tax, someone doubled their income to, say, $500,000, they'd be paying twice as much, let's just say, whereas this bill does not capture the higher income person's taxes on those dollars earned above the $250,000 level. Consequently, that we did a little analysis, that the percentage of the total revenue coming from very high earners, let's just say, would be lower in this bill versus a traditional income tax.
You mentioned Type S corporations a few moments ago. Would they be filing? I assume they would be filing a Schedule C or something similar at some point through which they would be paying this tax, since they don't currently file it or pay a tax. They simply file, did you call them information returns?
Information returns. Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, that's Type S corporations are an interesting conversation that we've been having, and partnerships very similarly. The reason they don't pay the corporate income tax is because they don't legally retain their income, that it gets passed through to their owners through a form known as a K-1, which is the same thing as partnership distributions are. And then the individual, that Schedule K, would pay their personal income tax based on their share of the earnings. There has been some effort and some attempt to try to find language to expand the footprint of the corporate income tax to, say, tax the earnings of type S corporations. It's complicated. It's doable. An easier way to do that, frankly, would be to have an income tax, because if so, all of those owners of that company who get their distributional paperwork would then pay this tax based on their share of the earnings of the company.
For example, there could be an owner of that type S corporation that lives out of state or in state. And
yes, Madam Chair. Well, if the income is Alaska originating, it would be taxable under this bill or a bill like this for the owner of a type S corporation. And that the bill doesn't have a lot of implementing language. We would obviously have a fairly rigorous regulatory process mm-hmm. to talk about all these bells and whistles of how we treat trusts and partnerships and S-corps mm-hmm. and estates and all those sorts of things. But for the most part, if it's all about pinning down what is the source in the state, what is the mechanism for paying it, and then how do they fall into these brackets?
Thank you. This is really interesting. I didn't think we'd be having an income tax or revenue discussion in education. So I actually appreciate the sponsor of the bill for bringing this forward. Let's see. I do have a question about the local share that the education piece, the local share that communities pay into their school operating budget through property or sales taxes or some other method. What can you tell us about that, and how would this impact that at all?
So, Madam Chair, I believe you're talking about the local mill rate that municipalities with a property tax pay in mm-hmm. to support school district funding in their community, and the foundation formula somehow backs out or adjusts for those communities that are able to pay that share. I don't fully comprehend in this bill, again, I'm just the tax man, the linkage between the revenue and how it would be appropriated towards the foundation formula. My sense is more like what Representative Kopp said in an earlier question, that presuming that the all-in foundation formula number is, let's say, $1.2 billion, and this bill would bring in $500 million, it would simply dollar for dollar swap out traditional GF for the revenue coming from this, and then the same universe of money would get apportioned to the school districts along the current formula structure.
It remains to be seen how this shakes out as we go along. Any more questions for Mr. Alper from the body? If not, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for coming. And please let us know if you need anything else. And we'll get a revised fiscal note into the committee.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Alper. All right. Any further questions from the committee? Anything else the sponsor wants to tell us at this time? All right. If there are no further questions, I'll set this bill aside for right now. And that's all the business that we have today. The next House Education meeting will be Friday, this Friday at 8 a.m., March 24th. We'll be talking about broadband again. We will have a follow-up discussion with some service providers that we met back in February, and we'll be hearing from the star of the Northwest Magnet School to hear what they're doing with the broadband resources they already have. Thank you very much, and I will adjourn this meeting at 8:48 a.m.